You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, hot, beautiful, hot, sunny, hot, Davis, hot day. And sunny. Don, it's hot.
Sunny is the relevant term. We're not going to see a cloud in the sky probably for, I would say at least a week or two for sure. It is indeed. We're in the middle of an epic heat wave here in the Sacramento Valley in Northern California and, of course, actually the entire state. It is Wednesday, July 3rd, as Lois and I are preparing this for broadcast on the 4th of July. And it is late morning and it's already 84 degrees. And we're going up to a high today, Wednesday, which I think is going to be the highest temperature of this episode, according to the National Weather Service, at 109 degrees for Davis. Yesterday's high temperature was 105, I believe they said here. The main thing people are really commenting on is the uncomfortable night temperatures. It only got down to about 73 last night, and that was very briefly. Most of the night was about 79 or 80 degrees. We're not used to that here. Here's how the temperature looks for the next few days with the excessive heat warning. The National Weather Service has got right up on their website. Thursday, Independence Day, will be 107 degrees and hot, obviously. Thursday night, cooling down to 65 and clear. Friday, 108 degrees and hot. Friday night, 65 degrees and clear. Saturday, 108 degrees. Saturday night, 64 degrees. Sunday, 106. Sunday night, 64. Monday, finally breaking this a little bit, going down to 102. Monday night will be 61. Yeah. And Tuesday will be 100 degrees. And finally, the heat wave, which will by then have lasted 8 days, will have broken. So Tuesday will be 100 degrees and Wednesday back into the 90s, apparently. What on earth is going on here? We've had two ridges. When we say ridge, that's high pressure building, often comes in right after some north wind. As we're recording this, the north wind is blowing. 15 to 30 mile an hour winds are being observed across many portions of the western half of the Sacramento Valley today. As we speak, it's very low humidity, critical fire weather conditions through this evening. Red flag warnings are up for much of the Sacramento Valley and the surrounding foothills. Today, Wednesday, strong anomalous high pressure remaining overhead throughout the forecast period. So prolonged dangerous heat event across the region. Daytime temperatures ranging from 105 to 118 degrees in the valley, all the way up in the north part of the valley and the adjacent foothills, peaking on Friday and Saturday. 75 to 100% chance of high temperatures of 110 degrees or higher through the northern and central Sacramento Valley, and about 50 to 80% chance of those kind of temperatures in the southern Sacramento and northern San Joaquin valleys, with little relief expected overnight. They are, of course, mentioning widespread major to extreme heat risk across interior Northern California. This level of heat risk is, and we're using capital letters here, very dangerous to anyone without proper hydration or adequate cooling. Strongly reconsider any outdoor activities during this prolonged heat event. Do not leave anything in unattended vehicles. Car interiors will quickly reach lethal temperatures in a matter of minutes. This remains in effect through the valley, the delta, and the foothills until 11 p.m. Tuesday. Okay, so 6-day extreme heat risk, what they're calling a warning for the entire Sacramento Valley and much of California. And that heat advisory remains in effect for the Sierra, Southern Cascades, and Bernie Basin all the way until 11 p.m. Tuesday. Wow. Okay. So the extended, the extended discussion, it's going to be very, very hot. Thing to keep in mind is that the surface temperatures are very high. I mean, surface temperatures like the parking lot you're walking on, the sidewalk that you're walking on, your dog is in severe pain if you're walking across it. So I hate to laugh, but I mean, I see this, it's really frustrating when you see it, when you're walking across a parking lot, if it's an unshaded parking lot. Turf areas, of course, are much better. Dry landscape areas are still quite hot. So, you know, if you have to be out there, stick to the shade, stick to the cooled and irrigated areas. Irrigation is what makes for a more habitable and safer environment in this kind of setting. The reason this is a big concern is that the 4th of July, there's all kinds of outdoor activities being promoted online right now. The city of Davis is having a big 4th of July festival out there at Community Park. They'll be doing fireworks at, I don't know, 9 p.m. or something like that, at which time it will still be well over 100 degrees. So, I don't know about the advisability of them failing to cancel those events. That's someone else's call, but I would suggest that maybe those aren't the best things to go to this year. I hate to put a spanner in the works, as they say in the UK, but this is not weather for being outside in the late afternoon. That's when the temperatures are obviously going to be the highest. From a gardening standpoint, a couple of things. One, the ET rate. We like to talk about the ET rate, the evapotranspiration rate, the rate at which plants need water. It's not the rate just at which they're using water. It also reflects evaporation of that water from surfaces, but it's the rate that you should be applying water. And it normally, average here in the Sacramento Valley, is about a quarter of an inch a day, about 0.25 inches per day. That's a measured amount that's used on a standardized surface. That standardized surface is a 4-inch tall fescue lawn that's been correctly irrigated, and they measure it a few feet above that. It's a measurable phenomenon. They have a machine that tells us, it's automated, that all these CIMIS weather stations, CIMIS weather stations all over California. And there may not be one near you, but there certainly is one near us, because we have a university campus that's an ag school here. So we can look it up every single day. So what was the ET rate yesterday when we got to 104, 105 degrees? 0.37 inch.
That's more than 0.25.
Indeed it is. It's about 50% higher in that one particular day. So someone asked me the very relevant question, how should I adjust my sprinklers with this kind of a heat wave?
So if it's 50% higher ET rate, couldn't I just expand my time by 50%? If I'm running it for 20 minutes, I'd run it for 30.
Yeah, the simple answer was yes, run it longer. And this is predicated on two things. One is the assumption that your soil is already at the correct moisture status, not bone dry. And two, that your current irrigation is adequate. And in many cases, that hasn't been the case. So we're assuming that everything is correct first. And then I can say, sure, you can look at the CIMIS station, or we can tell you that it's anywhere from 25 to 50% higher than average. So you should increase your duration of your run, how long it runs, by 25 to 50%. And in general, 25% is probably fine. But yesterday, as this heat built and there was some wind, it was a full 50% higher that particular day. Highest ET rate I've ever seen, just in case you all are the kind of data folks out there that like this information. As I say, our average here on a normal summer day is about a quarter of an inch. Highest I've ever seen in a single day was a half an inch in a single day when there was a north wind and the temperature was 107.
Well, you know, that describes today, because I'm looking out my back door and that's a heck of a wind going on there. It's a north wind.
Yes.
And it's over 100. Maybe we're going to break your record, Don.
Well, I hope not. But the humidity right now, as we speak, is already dropped down to 32%, and it's going to go down to probably 15 to 18%.
And it's 10 in the morning.
That's right. So the ET rate, the ET rate is going to be high. And the simple answer to his simple question was increase it 20 to 30%, because my guess is, that's not my guess. We know that the highest ET rate is going to be when the wind is blowing at its high temperature. When the wind stops and we get that ghastly still where the high pressure is parked over us, the ET rate is actually a little bit lower than it was the day the wind was blowing, because you don't have as much evaporation going on. It's still high, and it's definitely, we don't like it. People being out there when there's no air movement and it's that high temperature, that's just unpleasant as can be. But the ET rate today, with the north wind blowing and a very high temperature coming late in the afternoon, is going to be very high. And my answer to him was bumping it up 20 to 30% through this heat wave, which is going on a full 7 to 8 days, wouldn't be a bad idea. That can be as simple as running your system for a whole nother cycle. You know, just do it manually on the same day it's already run, run it again. All right. Go out and turn. Some of you, by the way, have smart timers that have figured this out on their own. But if you don't happen to have one of those, go up. If it's running 20 minutes, bump it up to 30 minutes throughout this period. And probably that will cover it.
And that might mean that it's going to be running off. And so you might not be able to go from 20 minutes to 30 minutes successfully. So you might have to run it a second time.
Second time is probably better, because then the first round of irrigation has soaked in and you don't have the likelihood of runoff. If you're in heavier soil parts of town, for local residents at Stonegate, for example, west of town, west end of town, Binning Track, North Davis Meadows, those are very heavy soils. Covell Park, regions that have more clay loam than silty loam or sandy loam, you can't put on all that water at once in one cycle. So you probably do need to break it up with a couple hours between cycles. You could run another cycle during the week if it came to that, but I'd rather have you do it all at once if you possibly can. So the key is run it 20 to 30% more throughout this. If it's really windy, it's okay to wash plants off. I mean, people are very concerned. I shouldn't get water on the leaves during these high temperatures. The plants will love it. Go ahead and wash them off if you want to. Go ahead.
So do you need to worry about the timing of your watering? I mean, I think most of us have probably gone for the 6 or 7 a.m. time because of the city's former requirements. But does it matter if it gets sprinkled on in the middle of the afternoon?
It doesn't matter to the plant. Yes, the city, of course, prefers that you water during the cooler times of day when there's less evaporation. You're not wasting the water. Although I would point out that evaporation is what makes it more comfortable for us to be around those plants. So some people are out there misting their plants for themselves at our nursery, where they were setting up little foggers to running our little mist system that we use for watering on one side. It was running for a good portion of the afternoon because it would blow around and make a nice cooling effect. That's not the best use of water, perhaps, but it does make a more habitable environment. I would love you to water longer all at once if you can. If you just can't do that because of runoff, break it up into a couple cycles on the same day. The humidity is so low that you don't have to worry about the plant being injured by moisture on the leaves for any amount of time leading to fungus. No, that ain't going to happen. Moisture around the crown leading to crown rot, definitely not going to happen. Unless you just trickled water there constantly. I don't want you keeping, plants soggy during this kind of thing, but I want a very thorough soaking. And I'm really concerned actually about the woody plants. Most people are keeping a pretty good eye on their vegetable gardens and their flower gardens and things like that. And they notice if they wilt. But those shrubs, those trees, if you haven't given them a real good soaking, like a several hour slow soak with a drip system or a hose or whatever, this would be a real good time to do that. I'm a little concerned about you all being out there. And I will tell you, this is just anecdotal. My own personal experience, since I still have things to get in the ground, I go out at dusk and plant them. Even though it's still high temperature, the sun is going down, not coming up. Okay, I'm not working in the sun, I'm working in the shade. My ability to stay out there too long is limited by the fact that it's about to get dark. So I have injured myself working early in the day. 9 o'clock, it'll be fine. Well, at 9 o'clock yesterday, it was 90 degrees. Okay.
Dawn is when you go out.
Sunrise. And the sun is coming up and the temperatures are rising. So to me, my own personal experience, you all can decide what's best for you. Whether you're going to rise at 5:30 to get your gardening done, you're going to go out there at 8 or 8:30 in the evening. I find dusk is best because then I can't stay out there too long unless I've got a flashlight on my shovel. Which, by the way, is a brilliant idea. If you all out there could invent a flashlight with a shovel or a flashlight on a trowel, I could stay out there all evening.
No, Don, no.
It's safer.
No, you folks out there, don't do that. We don't want him staying out all night.
But it's so much more comfortable out there. Here's the key question that keeps coming up. People are, of course, believe it or not, coming in and buying plants, even when it's 105 degrees. And then their next question is, should I plant this now? Or should I keep it in the shade and keep it watered? They say, well, the problem.
Don't keep it in the shade. It's a sunny plant.
That's the problem. It's a sun-loving plant. And we have this problem all the time at our nursery, where a plant will come in for a special order and we'll set it, the staff will set it over in the shade because they figure the people will come right down and pick it up. Well, if they don't come right down and pick it up, within 2 or 3 days, that plant is injured affected by being in more shade than that particular plant prefers. If it's a shade plant, fine. But if it's a lavender or even a tomato or something, putting it in the shade is not optimal. Also, taking it right out of the shade, if it's been sitting there for a couple of days or let's say a week because of a heat wave, and then putting it right out in the sun, the anatomy of the leaf has changed. The plant is now vulnerable to sunburn, whereas it wasn't before because it had been growing in the garden center in the sun. The main thing, though, that I will tell you is a plant in a pot right now, if it's in a 4-inch pot, a quart pot, little 6-packs, even a gallon can, but mostly the smaller sizes are needing water at our garden center 3 times a day. When we first come in the early afternoon and right before we leave. So if you've got this plant at home and you go to work, and I have some that I put in the ground, and I have the same plants sitting at home, you know, sitting out in the yard waiting to go in the ground. The plants in the ground are fine. I planted them a couple of days ago, right before the heat. I watered them in. I watered around them very thoroughly. I checked them the next morning. I gave one more little soaking then. They're fine when I get home. They didn't even need water until the next day. They could go 24 hours fully without irrigation. I mean, without getting watered again. I watered thoroughly when I did, but that meant there was, even though the roots hadn't expanded into the native soil was holding moisture, and some of that was presumably moving into the nursery soil by capillary action. I didn't have to rush out there and get them watered. By comparison, the exact same plant, the exact same age, sitting on a bench outside, was completely collapsed when I got home, and I had to resuscitate it by watering it. So I've got plants that are collapsing every day because I can't water them 3 times a day, and plants in the ground that are doing great. I strongly recommend that you go out when it's comfortable for you, get the plant in the ground, give it a very thorough watering. I mean, give it a gallon of water measured from a watering can or whatever is easier for you, and check it the next day, and you'll be surprised that it probably will not be collapsed from wilt, whereas the plant sitting, that same plant in a pot, will be collapsed from wilt. Yes, they can recover, but it isn't the best thing to have them collapsing every single day. So if you can get it planted, so much the better. If you can, and then the next question, should I shade the young plant? Sure, if you want, but it doesn't need it. These are sun-loving plants. These are tomato plants and peppers and squash and things like that. The plant doesn't need shade. So we'll get to the next part of this in just a moment.
Last question on this thing is like, okay, so you've got this plant at home and you're going to work, and then when you come back, you've got a problem. Well, what about just taking the plant with you to work? You could put it in the car take it there, and then you could come out to the car and water it a couple times a day.
Where it will cook. Yes, it'll be completely dead if you leave it in your car. I absolutely guarantee it. If you want to sterilize something real fast, leave it in your car for just a couple hours in these temperatures. Your car will be 150 degrees when you open it. I may be exaggerating, but not by much. So your car is one of the least safe places for anything. Right now, we ask people when they're buying,
including people.
Well, yeah, but including houseplants. I mean, this is the thing that people are coming in buying a lot of houseplants. And we say right before they leave, are you going right home? Oh, I was going to stop at the store. If you do park in the shade, it would be better if you went right home. Literally 10 minutes in the sun in your car will be really, really bad for this plant. And so it'd be better if you could just go straight home. So I'm not wishing to be a downer on all of your planned outdoor activities. Gardening is a fun thing to do when it's not dangerously hot outside, but to work around the high temperatures of the day. And keep in mind that a plant in the ground is much easier to water than a plant in a container. I guess that's the bottom line here. Okay.
So, you know, Don, we're on Catered. And KDRT is our local radio station. We have lots of people making lots of shows, and we've got a new one.
Yeah.
The newest show in our lineup is called Audio Ecotone with your host, Eddie Oat. It's Fridays, 3 p.m. It's only here on KDRT. And the description says... Yeah. The Audio Ecotone is an off-the-beaten-path journey into sound zones, old and new, music of the last 100 years, familiar and just a bit strange. Fridays at 3 p.m. Pacific time on KDRT. And if you're listening to this someplace else, kdrt.org streams, and you can listen to them live.
KDRT is community radio. That means we rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating cost. If you like what you hear and all this great programming here at KDRT, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. There's all kinds of events we always like to talk about, but I'm going to go ahead and mention the California Raptor Center in case you're thinking of heading over there. Due to this week's heat, we are closed to the public through Sunday, July 7th. Good plan. However, that's a great website, lots of great information there, and they do continue their educational programs through the summer in various ways. So if you want to find out what you can do and when you can go there after the heat wave is over, you can go to, and I'm going to read this carefully, CRC, which stands for California Raptor Center, crc.vetmed.ucdavis.edu. Okay, we got questions.
We do. But first, we have one that just walks into the store all the time. Don, there's a heat wave. Do I need to put shade cloth over my tomato plants? All my neighbors are doing it.
Well, this should be an interesting experiment. Think about what they're doing, which is draping shade cloth over their plants, much as one might put frost blanket over the plants in the winter to protect them from cold. Not your tomatoes.
Wait a minute. That keeps them warmer.
Yeah.
Oh,
what would be wrong with putting shade cloth, draping it over a plant? You could cook it. You could do significant injury to that plant. So if, and here's the thing, tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and squash and melons and all those things we grow in our summer vegetables are full sun loving plants. Many of them come from climates, watermelons from climates that are hotter than here regularly. And they survive that by being deep rooted or by getting plenty of moisture. They don't survive it by being in the shade. Shade is not optimal for any of your summer vegetables. They won't produce as well. They'll grow. I mean, if you ever planted a tomato plant in partial shade, it will grow very vigorously. It'll have bigger internode distances. It'll yield significantly less. If your concern is the fruit, which I assume is what most people are concerned about, they're trying to shade the plants to protect the fruit. Fruit that has not entered the ripening phase, fruit that is still in the cell division or fruit expansion phase, when it is still dark green, is not going to be injured by direct sun on the fruit. It has a waxy coating that protects it. As long as the plant is adequately watered, that waxy coating will remain thick enough to protect the plant. So one of the side effects of drought stress is that the fruit becomes more vulnerable to sunburn. So don't drought stress your plants. Once the fruit begins to enter the ripening stage, then it goes to what commercially they call breaker stage. It's gone from dark green to even slightly lighter green. That's when they pick them to send to the grocery store, because they know that this, it's a climacteric fruit is the term we use for a fruit which continues to ripen after having been removed from the plant. The sugar still increases, the acidity changes, and so forth. It goes to full ripening even after being removed from the plant. Peaches and tomatoes are really good examples of climacteric fruit. So they can pick them rock hard. Once they've gotten to a certain stage, they will ripen at a predictable rate, typically about 6 to 7 days, regardless of whether they're attached to the vine or not. They will get more flavor if they're attached to the vine. But when it's above about 95 degrees, ripening stops on the vine. So the whole process, the whole metabolism of the plant changes to sort of a self-protective mode. Ripening of the fruit stops. So it will just sort of freeze at that stage. The other thing that happens as it goes into the ripening stage is that thick, that waxy coating on the fruit thins out. So that fruit is now more vulnerable to sunburn if it's exposed to direct sun. You can look at your plant and make some decisions. If the fruit is on the inside, shaded by the leaves, it'll probably be okay, although it'll ripen more quickly. And I tell people this, and they're always a little surprised, inside than out right now. You bring it in, your house is probably temperatures in the 80s. That's fine for fruit ripening. You can just set it on your counter, and it'll ripen over 5 to 7 days through a very steady progression to the color that that variety is supposed to be, almost no matter what you do. If you leave it on the vine, it'll sort of stop, and then it'll ripen a little bit more when the temperature, and then it'll stop, and then it'll go. It may take as much as 10 to 14 days to ripen. And it would have done that same ripening on your kitchen counter in 5 to 7 days. The fruit that is in the process of ripening that is exposed to the hottest sun of the day is going to be vulnerable to sun scald, sunburn of the fruit. That's what you probably should protect. You can protect it if you wish by putting a few stakes in the ground, putting some shade cloth or whatever on the stakes so they cast a shadow onto the plant after about, let's say, 2 or 3 p.m. and all the way into the early evening. That could protect the fruit on the vine, or you could just remove that fruit from the vine and bring it in and set it on your counter. I highly recommend considering that for your peppers because they're really vulnerable to sun scald. Shading them Shading peppers is a different conversation. It works and people are doing it. I've got one guy who's growing all his peppers in 50% shade and he gets fewer fruit, but less of it sunburned. So he's happy. But with the tomatoes, it's the fruit you're concerned about, or if it's the fruit you're concerned about, you could shade that fruit by casting shadow on it, not by draping something over the plant, casting shadow on it from a certain time of day on, let's say 2 or 3 p.m. all the way into the end of the day. Or you could just pick the fruit that you're concerned about, bearing in mind that rock hard green fruit that has not entered the ripening phase probably will not be affected by direct sun on the fruit, even at these temperatures.
So you said that tomatoes ripen on the counter.
Continue to ripen after now, you put them. Yes.
I have plums that are not ripe yet, and it's going to be 100 degrees all week. Is the heat going to make those plums stop ripening like the tomatoes, or is it going to speed up the ripening, or is it not going to have an effect? Not all of the plums are in the sun. Most of them are shaded by the tree.
Yeah, fruit, and this is an interesting question with fruit trees. The foliage of many species shades the fruit adequately that it's not a concern, but we're getting to such extreme temperatures that certain freestone fruits spoil around the pit if it gets very high temperature. So what doesn't slow down is spoilage. Okay, so ripening slows down, and it presumably slows down on climacteric stone fruits just as it does on tomatoes, or it could be uneven. But as they detach from the pit, which is an extremely important characteristic to the public, by the way, freestone is just... I had a guy bring back a peach tree one time because it turned out it was a cling, not a freestone. He was that upset about it. He walks up the path carrying a tree that he's dug out of the ground and said, "You didn't tell me this was a cling." You're correct. I didn't tell you that. I'm very sorry. But so freestone is extremely important to many people. And unfortunately, one side effect of that is as they pull away from the pit, it becomes vulnerable to injury. And I'm not talking about bugs getting in there. I mean, that can happen. But what it actually is very, very high temperatures can cause spoilage of the part of the fruit that was attached to the pit but isn't any longer. And in particular, apricots, which are soft flesh, that injury can spread very rapidly into the flesh and just ruin them. And it looks fine from the outside. Here's the frustrating part. Yet another reason never to just bite into a fruit. Always cut into it first. That's an absolute rule at our household. You know, cut it first, make sure there's no worms or spoilage in there before you just casually bite into it. And apricots in particular, well, plums are pretty similar and it can happen to them. I've only ever seen it a couple times, but this is the kind of event when that would be possible to have occur. So you might pick a bunch of them and bring them in, even though they're not fully ripened. Yes, they will continue to ripen on your kitchen counter. It would be a good precaution if you've got a young peach tree out there and it's giving you your first crop ever, and they're 2 weeks away from ripening or a week away from ripening, and you think they're going to be injured by this heat. Well, it's possible. I mean, it has happened. And so this might be worthy of picking the 10 or 12 of them at least and putting them on the counter and letting them ripen inside and then doing a little test. See which ones ripen best. See which ones are more consistent in their ripening. It could injure them. Yes, to answer your question, the shorthand is that the heat could cause the spoilage to progress faster than the ripening. Any soft fleshed fruit is vulnerable to injury. Look particularly for fruit where there's been any little injury on the, you know, like just a bird pecking on the peel, making any point of entry. Well, the ethylene reaction in the plant is immediate and the spoilage begins. Usually it's also ripening. So you pick that, you cut a little bit out, everything's fine. If it's really hot, the spoilage continues, the ripening doesn't, the fruit will be ruined. So go out and do some selective removal just to make sure. But in the case of something like a plum, you usually have, 500 fruit? So it's not like it's going to be that big a deal. Yeah. With your tomatoes, on the other hand, you know, this is the first of the season that are ripening and everybody's very concerned about them. Keep in mind also, folks, locally, our garden season goes all the way through the middle of October. Even if all that fruit is ruined, even if your plant is completely wiped out by this heat, which won't happen, but pretend that happens, there's plenty of time for them to set more fruit and have a great crop in September and even into October. But shrouding the plant with shade cloth seems like a very bad plan to me.
Well, we have a couple of emails that came. David in Antioch writes, "Don and Lois, I need your help. It's the first week of July, and most of my tomatoes are already at the top of the cages. Would you let them run over, extend the cages that are already 5 to 6 feet tall, chop the tops off and hope they bush else or something else? And he sent some pictures of these lovely tomatoes that are very vigorous and shooting for the sky.
Yep. Modern tomato cages. This has been a big frustration to me as a retailer, is that I cannot get good quality tomato cages at a reasonable price that are big enough for any self-respecting tomato. Assuming you're growing an indeterminate tomato plant, it can grow in the Sacramento Valley, planted in May. By the end of the season, it will have grown 8 to 12 feet. It's a vine-like plant. It's not a true vine. Actually, what it is a giant ground cover. If you've ever had, you ever want to have some fun, you got plenty of space, plant a tomato plant, don't cage it. I've done this occasionally, and just see what it does. I can tell you exactly what it will do. You need to plan for about a 6-foot diameter circle. It will spread past that, but that's where the basic mass of foliage would be, and it'll grow fine. This is what it does in nature. It doesn't climb, you know, it might scramble up on a shrub, but it can also just cascade across the ground. And it will produce very heavily. And a lot of your fruit will be spoiled only because it's close to the ground. If it's touching the soil or it's closer for insects and possums and others to come in and feed on it. So you got a big plant, and yet we all have to sell you 3-foot tomato cages. Or if you're really doing well and you find a good garden center, 4-foot tomato cages for an 8 to 12 foot vine. That does lead to a problem in our area. If you stake them higher, if you add another cage or something, you get a north wind like we're getting today, and it's just
blow it over.
It's just going to be a mess. I live out in the country, so I use roughly 6-foot tomato cages that I've made out of concrete wire. You can also make them out of large opening woven wire if you prefer, and that's somewhat safer, but mostly those are 4-foot and mine are 6-foot. And I stake those cages with a metal tri-stake that I've pounded a foot into the ground. And I anchor them very securely to that because every year we get a north wind sometime during the growth cycle of the tomatoes. And it'll, you know, nothing less pleasant than trying to deal with a tomato cage full of tomato foliage and fruit that's blown over. That's a two-person job, and it's very challenging to deal with. So plan ahead. Plan ahead for it. You are dealing with the problem that you now have another 2 months of growth on that tomato. Topping it is not optimal. Side shoots that have gone out the side, you can snip off. I do that all the time. I try to poke them back in for a while, but at some point I snip them off. The more you prune it, the less fruit you'll get. Is what it comes down to. But if you don't prune it or shape it at all, you'll get a pretty big tangled mess. My father's approach was to take a 6-foot stake and put it in next to the plant and continue tying it up to that at least. So you could go out and you can find a 6-foot 1x1. You're going to pound it in, saturate the soil first before you do this. Pound it in so it's about a foot in the ground. That gives you another foot or so. Tie a few more branches up to that. At that point, the plant cascades back to the ground, and your major late season harvest, as with mine, will be on the branches that are outside the tomato cage. So people are beginning to pick now and planning ahead for the fruit that's set over the last few weeks, which is inside the tomato cage. Your big late season harvest will be outside the tomato cage. So try to let it cascade down locally if you possibly can, not all over each other. It's best not to have them scrambling all over each other. But you're in the conundrum most of us are, which is that if you bought a tomato cage, it's not big enough for the tomato plant and you just make do as best you can. I would consider staking them up a little bit higher, tying some of the branches up to a higher stake, a 6-foot stake or something like that. And then at that point, they cascade back down to the ground. His technique, my dad's technique, was that he would put this stake in next to the plant, he'd tie it to the stake until he either lost interest or got to the top of the stake, one of those two things. He always planted his plants 3 feet apart in San Diego. So he was planting them in January or February. They turned into a solid hedge of tomato mess, is basically the way we looked at it. It was as long as whatever he had planted, and it was all one plant at that point. And they cascaded all the way to the ground. And the frost-free climate, they'd go all the way into December. So it was pretty much a big mess, and he would ultimately just take it out, even though they hypothetically could even go through the winter down there. He would take it out just because of how overgrown and messy and sort of gross it had gotten to try and go in there and harvest. I would suggest wider spacing in the future if you possibly can, because that way you'll get the full benefit of each plant. But to the greatest extent possible, don't let them scramble all over each other. It is okay to side prune them a little bit. You might reduce your yield somewhat by doing that, but if you have to do it to fit them in your spot, that's fine. Those of you that are limited for space should probably look into some of the semi-determinate or determinate, like the dwarf versions of Early Girl, the dwarf versions of Champion. taller tomato cages are something you're going to have to make yourself. You're just not going to find them at most retailers because the price has gotten so high and the quality has diminished. And I don't have an easy answer to this one except to go to your local feed store where they sell wire products for fencing livestock. Take a look at what's there. If it's a feed store that's willing to cut pieces for you, spectacular, because that'll save you a lot of trouble. And then just get them cut for that purpose. And it should be a minimum 4 feet high. I go to 5 to 6 foot wherever I possibly can. Every year, I stick some tomatoes in the ground after all my cages are occupied, all my systems are in place, and then someone hands me another 6 tomatoes to plant. So I do. I stick them in the ground, and I'll usually put a single stake on them, and that's adequate. But that takes a lot of space in the garden that a lot of you probably don't have. So the main purpose of staking that we have is to keep them up off the ground and to be able to plant more tomato varieties in a small space. The more vertical you can go, fine. I would say 5 to 6 foot cages are optimal. That's been my experience. That kind of gives you the best of both worlds. They're pickable. They can fit in a 4 foot space. If you put your plants 4 feet apart with a 5 foot cage, you should be able to manage them all and get maximum yield, and that minimizes the pruning. So I hope that answered your question. A taller stake could be helpful. Side pruning is okay, reduces yield a little bit. And now you've got 2 months of watching your tomatoes become a jungle.
Well, looking at our email, I've come across a message from Braden. I am growing 6 tomato plants, among other things, in containers in my driveway. They are producing well, and we have been enjoying a variety of tomatoes. 2 of the plants have been looking poorly for a few weeks now, with leaves that turned purplish, then yellow, and then dried out and die. They are the only tomatoes that I have sharing a big container, and these boxes are about 2 foot wide, 3 foot long, and 2 feet deep. That's deep. The box is sitting on concrete, but I recently removed some litter leaf from the base of a box, and there are roots that I believe to be tomato coming out of the bottom of the box. First, I thought they weren't getting enough water, so I began to supplement the regular drip watering with an extra hose watering each day. They continued to look poorly, so I thought maybe it might be too much water, and eliminated the extra waterings. They continued getting worse, and I wondered if it might be too much or not enough fertilizer. And then he goes on to describe how he tried to sleuth it out, looking at things and finding little bugs and the hairs on the tomato plants and all other stuff. And his belief was that he thought maybe it was Fusarium or Fusarium wilt, because he had looked at pictures online.
Yeah.
So the outlook of if it's one of those two sounds pretty dire. I just made the planter beds this year and spent a fair amount of money on quality potting soil. Is there anything I can do to salvage the plants and or the soil? Or better yet, please tell me this is something easier to deal with. Maybe I just need to water more or less.
Great pictures.
Attached pictures.
Yeah, great pictures. And I'm going to say this first part. It would be extremely unusual for Verticillium or Fusarium to be attacking container plants in imported potting soil. That just wouldn't be the case. You might have one plant with it, but all of them doing this tells me that there's something else going on here. Fusarium wilt is actually a surprisingly easy one to recognize early in the season. The flagging is very recognizable, and we do have Fusarium wilt here in the Davis area, which is a major tomato producing region, but this isn't the pattern of Fusarium wilt. Well, I agree that it could look like Verticillium wilt. I just don't see buying in soil, filling it with containers. There's no connection to our native soil here or wherever this is. I just think that's extremely unlikely. And it would be, short of paying a plant pathologist or a lab or something to test it, I don't know of any way to confirm one way or the other, but this just seems, it isn't the way it would go. That's the thing. However, I do look at one note here. Momotaro, Pineapple, Sweet 100, Sun Gold, Paisano. There's no plants there in that group that have the genetically bred in Verticillium resistance. So first of all, just with respect to that, even though I don't think this is Verticillium, it is best to split your portfolio between heirloom and hybrid. And the hybrids should have VFN characteristic, at least here. And if you're listening to us back east, you might also want some of the late blight resistance and things like that. But this is the problem with focusing more on varieties that don't have the VFN. Having said that, I just don't think this is verticillium. I think that would be very unlikely for it to happen in this manner. I suspect that there's something about the soil you brought in that it's having difficulty holding nutrients. It's having difficulty holding moisture. And I don't know what brand it is that you used or whether it was something you got from a rock yard, but almost invariably, those are deficient in certain macronutrients, almost always deficient in nitrogen. The first thing that I noted as I'm listening, reading through this was the initial discoloration with a purple discoloration, which would indicate a nutrient deficiency. Actually, that's usually a phosphorus deficiency, although it can also be temperature related with respect to low temperatures. So if this goes way back when, you might have been seeing a problem there. My guess is that this is primarily an irrigation problem. It might be a distribution thing. It might be that there's a lot of coarse material in this, this potting soil, so water is just running through and it's not retaining moisture at all. It might simply be that you haven't watered effectively, that your water is not distributing properly across the soil. I would be going out there with a trowel the day after irrigating and poking all around to see, is the moisture evenly distributed? Poke down 6 to 8 inches. Is it moist all the way down? Water more thoroughly with a hose, perhaps. This is the very common problem we have, is drip on containers with relatively coarse soils. The water doesn't redistribute adequately by capillary action, so you just get sort of channels of wet and channels and areas of dry, and the roots struggle for that reason. So my guess is that this is a water distribution problem that could be solved at least temporarily by getting a nice soft rain nozzle, putting it on your hose, and standing there for a full minute with the hose at full throttle, showering over the plant and the soil, the whole surface of the soil, till you see water coming out the bottom. So you know you've watered all the way through, and do each of that to each of those plants. And then go out the next day with a trowel, a long trowel of some sort, or a probe of some sort, and try to figure out whether you got good distribution of this, of the moisture. It would be helpful to know what exactly you filled those containers with, because I think that's your problem. Right there. I think the problem is the soil that's in the containers, and it's not holding nutrients and it's not holding moisture properly for you. And now that we're getting into very high temperatures, you may have to water a lot in order to keep those plants or get them to resprout and start flowering and start fruiting again. That's my best guess. It doesn't look from your pictures like a vascular disease, although I agree that, you know, once you get to yellowing and leaf drop, that they all look kind of like that. It looks to me like there's been some sort of a serious watering problem and inability of the plants, also of the soil, to hold nutrients. Correcting that can be an interesting challenge. I've had customers use earthworm castings. Interestingly, earthworm castings are rather pricey, but they're very dense. They're like enriched soil, and they are enriched. The earthworms have taken the soil and passed it through their digestive systems, so you have very dense worm poop. And the advantage of that is threefold. It is got a lot of nitrogen in it. They usually don't claim a nitrogen content to earthworm castings, but it's about 3% nitrogen, comparable to chicken manure, but not as rapidly acting. So it's sort of a gentle way to feed. It would help to fill in the soil particle areas between the coarser materials, because it's a pretty fine material. Earthworm castings look, frankly, like dirt. And you sprinkle them on the surface and you scratch them in a little bit and you water them in. It doesn't take a whole lot, I think, to make some benefit here. And they're very ionically active, meaning they retain nutrients and they retain water better than and the other things that are in your soil mix there. So I would, you know, one bag would go a long way. You don't need to completely bury these things in worm casting, because they're going to be a little surprised by the price. But you'll probably find that that is something that might make your managing the nutrients and water easier. Anyway, Lois.
A whole bunch of questions. The first one is, if he does what you say, how will he know if watering was the problem? Are these plants so far gone that they're not coming back?
Nope. There could be new growth pretty quickly. And that would be what you'd watch for. And I see signs of, you know, there's some green leaves in here and there's some branches that just look droopy and wilted. My guess is those droopy things would perk up right away and new growth would come out. You might need to do some pruning out of the older parts if you've lost whole branches on them. When you do that, by the way, go back to that UCANR website I hope there's some picture on it that shows you what those two diseases, Fusarium and Verticillium, look like when you cut into a stem. When I was a student, they'd cut them and they say, see the stained portion of the cambium? And we're all standing there staring at it going, well, no, but if we knew what we were looking for, we might. So it's not that easy to see, but it's something you can look for. I see hope. I'm looking at the third or fourth picture in here, and there's just a lot of yellowing and the plant's looking droopy and very stressed, as it would with a wilt disease, but also as it would if there is an irrigation problem. I'm guessing that one, I can actually see the little dripper down here. It looks like there's one on this plant. I think you need them all through the garden bed. So if you're gonna go away from hand watering, first of all, try the hand watering thing we just talked about. But if you're going to go away from that, try to use a system in these planters. This is a rare case where I'm going to suggest Netafim. I'm not a fan of the brand for a bunch of reasons, but this is one case where you can go out and you can go buy that emitterized tubing where they have an emitter every 6 inches. Look for the highest output one you can get, but that doesn't matter that much because you can determine how long it runs. Run that all through the bed. I mean, so that every 6 inches of soil surface, there's a dripper. And so you're basically going to go in and you're going to loop it around the plant and even further out if you have to, so that there's several of them in there. So you know that when you water, water is distributing all over the surface, not just at the base of the plant, as it appears to be doing from what I can see from the picture. Great pictures, by the way. We really appreciate this. My guess is that right there, you could take that one thing off, put in a little connector. These are quarter inch connectors, run some Netafim tubing throughout each planter to the point that it's distributed all over the surface. Water until you see water coming out the bottom, measure how long that takes. That would be the simple correction, you know, going forward. But right now you can just go out there with a soft rain nozzle. It's a wonderful device. It breaks up the flow of your hose into a shower. We use them at our nursery all the time. Most nurseries use these regularly because they turn a jet blast of water into a rain of water. And you can go out there and you can just move slowly back and forth over the soil and really hydrate it that way. In the long run, it'll simplify your life if you just shift over to something that distributes the water a little more effectively.
So since this is not a disease with a pathogen, probably, there is no need to destroy the plants to, when the season is over, remove the soil and replace the soil or anything like that.
Not
because
necessarily,
it's not a pathogen.
Probably.
If you figure out that it is, in fact, a watering thing. So what I would ask you is, and for any other listener who's going to be writing into us, there's a few key things that we'd like to know when you send in a problem like this. Mm-hmm. First off is, where do you live?
Well, that helps, yes.
Very important. Yeah. This person built planters. Now, is the planter open on the bottom so the water can just run out and run onto the concrete? Or is it covered up so that this is basically a bathtub?
Yeah, don't do that.
Don't do that. Yeah, but that's key, you know, key to know. And then how long are you watering? How are you watering? Yeah. And as Don said, how many drippers do you have per 2x3 foot planter?
Yeah, every single day we have to ask these questions of people who come in with a bunch of different plant problems. They bring us a leaf, and the first question we ask is, it boils down to, how are you watering? But we get very, very funny answers in response to that. My favorite is, oh, pretty good. Okay, sir, I really need a little more detail than, oh, pretty good. But what are you watering with? You know, a hose, a system, and so on. What does it have? Emitters. I don't need the brand. I just would be best if I knew the output. But basically what I know is, are you running the system for a couple hours and there's a bunch of emitters, or are you running it for 20 minutes and there's one emitter? I mean, there's a wild range of output there. So, you know, we can start with, are you using drip or sprinklers? How long do you know the output? Great. If not, how long are they running, more or less? But I think what I'm seeing here is very, very probably, partly at least, a distribution problem. So that's one thing to look at. But yes, how are you watering is useful information. Fortunately, your pictures, which are outstanding, included a picture of what appears to be a bubbler at the base of the plant. So it may seem like putting a lot of.
And having a picture of the drip outputter is it's very useful, because Don has lots of different terms for things. And sometimes the people don't know what the terms mean.
Yeah. Well, how many GPH are you getting there?
Yeah. I know what a mini sprinkler is, but when I first heard it, I thought that was a short sprinkler going chunk out your yard. You know, no, it's
like
not
a miniature sprinkler. I got it. Well, it is kind of.
And yeah. So if you're sending in stuff and your question includes anything that might possibly have to do with watering, please send us a picture of what you water with. That we love.
In this particular case, we could see it. It's interesting what a range of output there is, not just between sprinklers and drip, but within drip. I mentioned Netafim, and I always do throw in my fairly negative feelings about it because we see a lot of problems with irrigation systems with that brand. It's not the company's fault, just for the record. It is the way they're installed and used, obviously. But the most popular version has 0.4 gallon per hour emitters. Okay, 0.4 gallon per hour, typically about a foot apart. All right. So a tomato plant that's relying on that is getting two of those emitters somewhere near its base. It's getting 0.8 gallons per hour. For you to water enough, that has to run for an hour and a half plus. 2 hours is a very typical watering cycle for me. I don't even use Netafim. I use a higher output. 2 hours is what I just ran my drip system on my tomatoes so that each plant in my case would get 4 gallons of water all at once. All at once. So I know I don't need to run that again for a couple of days, even though the temperatures are very high.
Well, let's get something from our email. Melissa, who lives in Southern California in Glendale, writes, I have a problem with a tomato plant. I have 3 tomato plants in the same raised bed. One has what looks like random branches that wilt and go crispy. The other 2 plants look very healthy. Could it be some fungal issue? Maybe Versilium wilt? Here are more details about the raised bed. I top it off with fresh compost every year. It is set up with automatic drip irrigation and is lightly covered with mulch. Pictures are attached.
Yes.
Thank you, Lois and Don. Your show is one of my favorite highlights.
Well, thank you. So what I see here, again, going to verticillium, just for those of you who don't deal with verticillium and fusarium, they are pretty common problems here in the Sacramento Valley. I don't know how much of a problem they are in Glendale, but they follow pretty characteristic patterns of how they damage the plant. And it isn't a branch here and a branch there. Random branches that wilt and go crispy. Usually you can go in, and I was able to do this on a picture someone posted in a Facebook group. It was a great picture because they thought they had verticillium. But I could see from the picture and zooming in on it, I could see the point of infection on the leaf and on the stem, not on that whole side of the plant. So if it's up on the plant, and it's not progressing up from the ground, it is not good news, verticillium, almost certainly, because that's a vascular disease that enters through the roots and goes up through the plant's cambium. So when you have something that's hitting a branch here and a branch there, especially if you're anywhere near the coast and you might actually get some moisture for a longer period of the day than we do here in the Sacramento Valley, you very likely got a little bit of late blight. Late blight will attack on the stem or on a leaf and infects rapidly and kills everything past that point. So if it's at the base of a leaf, it kills that leaf. If it's on the stem of one side of the plant, that part of the plant dies. But everything else basically looks healthy. So the rest of the plant's root and vascular system is not affected. So my guess is that if you were to go in and find any one of those points where the branch or the leaves have gotten wilty like that, and just start working your way back down the stem, first the petiole and then onto the main stem, you'll probably find the point of infection because it infects splashing on from another point of infection. And this is where watering during the day can cause a problem. So good timing on this question with respect to the previous one. Pruning that out here, that's all we typically have to do anywhere in California where, you know, we're even in Glendale, you're sunny in the afternoon, right? So you can go ahead and just prune out the affected portion, dispose of that. Don't just leave it on the ground. Take that away, bag it and get rid of it. Look around on the plant for any other points nearby, especially where you saw that. So a leaf nearby that's affected or a part of a stem that's affected. Go ahead and prune those out. This is a case where watering the plant overhead in the late afternoon, early evening might splash it. You might get further infection if you're in part of California where fog rolls in, where you have coastal influence predictably. Then you can get problems with disease splashing from point to point if you wash the foliage down at such a time that it would stay damp for several hours. So if you have to wash the plant off for aphids or whatever, do it early in the day if you possibly can. But this is something you can prune out. Those of you listening in high rainfall, high temperature summer areas, you know already that late blight is one of your worst problems. It can spread very rapidly. You get a rainstorm in the summer, which comes with wind and splash. Your late blight can go from that plant all the way down the row of plants. And if it rains again the next day, everything can be wiped out. So you are probably much more aware than Californians are of how rapidly this particular problem can spread, and it's much likelier to spread in places like that. It almost never spreads here to become a major concern because we don't have overhead sprinkling going on. Typically, this is a sort of a fluke phenomenon for us, whereas in rainier climates, it's a big deal. If you're in an area where that's a problem, all of the seed companies now, Burpee and Johnny's and all of them, have hybrids that have resistance to late blight. I do not know how it works. I've been meaning to ask a couple of my customers who are tomato breeders, can you explain to me where late blight resistance in a tomato variety comes from? I don't know how it functions, but they have it on there. So that whole alphabet soup you're seeing now in seed catalogs where this new variety has and this whole bunch of letters, VFN, the ones we know, and then a bunch of others that indicate resistance to tobacco mosaic virus. Late blight is the one that you'd be looking for, and it can make a big difference for you to buy these more disease-resistant varieties, at least for some of your plant selection, in case you have a year where you get a lot of rainfall and spreads the disease. California, even coastal parts of California, it's really rare for that to ever become a serious problem for us. We don't spray fungicides on tomatoes out here. You just don't need to. Whereas in those rainier climates, typically I understand you get into a pattern beginning in the season, and you just start rotating the following fungicides, and seems like a tough way to grow a garden. But out here, we don't typically have that problem. Prune it out. My guess is it's late blight. You can look closer as you do the pruning and see if you can find the point of infection. You can stop the problem in its tracks just by removing the affected portion and disposing of it.
Looking at our email, I have a question from Gaina. Yep. Who writes, hi there. I saved some daffodil bulbs in peat moss about 6 months ago to plant later this year. I saw that Walden bulbs sprouted in the dark and in the peat moss. Should I throw it away? Also, please remind me when I should plant daffodils. It'll be in a large pot in my case. Well, thanks so much.
No reason to throw it away. If you dig up where bulbs are planted in your garden, this happens to me periodically as I'm out planting something. Oops, there are bulbs there. Oh, well, they're already sprouting. They're already beginning to root out. So they don't stay dormant through the summer in the ground completely. The one that's sprouting in the dark and in the peat moss, you can go ahead and stick that in a pot somewhere or put it in the ground. Generally speaking, we store them and plant them in October. Even in November, even as late as December or January would be fine. But there's absolutely nothing
wrong. Daffodils, they'll grow.
They will. They're fine. Yeah. It's not like we have to put them through some special chilling process or anything like that. We're usually just digging them up and storing them so we can plant them in the fall for bloom the following spring. But if they're in soil, they're already beginning to root out. So don't throw that away by any stretch, but you might stick it in a pot since it's trying to sprout. Go ahead and get that one into a pot and give it a little head start on the others. I'd be curious whether it blooms ahead of the others or just puts on more foliage ahead of the others, which I think is more likely. No need to throw it away. Typically, we plant daffodils starting mid to late October. November, December, January are also fine.
There is a quote that I have just seen, and I really like, to plant a garden is to believe in tomorrow.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
That's a great way to end the program. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.